Oh, you're on web call? So then you can hear us then, Bob.
No, you typed open a web call.
Oh, well, no. If he's on a web call, then he can hear Achieve Radio, which means he can hear us. But since he can't, which means his computer is fucking muted.
Oh, that's odd.
For himself, which would be very annoying.
Yeah. We are audible over Achieve. I was just me.
Allow the director to change your audio speaker to...
No, ignore that. Okay. I thought I was fucking with Bob's audio, but I hit you by mistake.
Oh, so I did.
Oh, wait. Bob can hear us now? Great, but we just can't hear him.
All right.
But now we can't... Oh, wait.
What?
No, here. I'll request to go back to his mic. Oh, here. There. Go back to your laptop mic. There we go. Now we can hear...
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
You can hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Can you hear us? Amazing.
So what happened?
I don't know.
Half of these went out. Battery dead. The one was still working. But it's too weak. So I put the new one in. But they wouldn't connect.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know why they wouldn't connect. Maybe so I saw you wave the hand, so I took that start over again. So I went at the link and a Firefox and came in and you still couldn't hear me and I couldn't hear you. So I said, what the fuck's happening here? So I said, okay, I'll go to these.
Okay,
and,
but
listen,
Steve's calling bullshit on our little skit here. He sees through the lines.
No, wait a minute, listen. So I went to these, but because these were still in my ear, it blocked it. So I took these out of my ear and put them in. And then that allowed this to go through.
Oh, okay. Great.
And that's why I can hear me. So these two modalities were conflicting with this.
Right.
So,
okay.
So
well,
I'm now here.
Okay, then we are good
but
to go.
Excellent.
Now we can listen to...
Wait a minute. I got to turn this on. You're not in my headphones.
Oh, okay. I feel like we shouldn't break
okay.
it. Okay, great. So let's watch, and we'll just do it from this part because it's good enough. I'll be honest with you. I don't want to fuck around with what's working. Here's
no. Go back.
No, this is ahead of where we need to go. This precedes what we want to see. I assume this part.
Yeah, we did go back. This is actually about 30 seconds ahead of the line that I wanted to highlight, so it's perfect. But it's quite quiet. So.
Yeah.
The sound might be on right now.
Yes, it is.
So this is this bizarre institute that the movie takes place at.
Oh, no.
It's very strict.
But we can't hear the movie.
Here we go. I'm just going to
There might be no sound anymore.
No, it was crackling. Hold on. I'm just going to...
Okay.
I'm trying to play
well, there is
YouTube
a sound
live
as well. I don't know.
So we didn't get to hear it.
We'll hear it. You'll hear it. Here it comes. Are you ready to hear
there
it?
There are long silence and then strange crackles, but here we go. We need more volume.
Yeah.
Before when you tested it out before, it came in at this faint volume, and then you managed to get it right up to big. So, I don't know how you did that, but.
Sorry, my web browser here is choking hard. It's fucking coughing up blood. It's barely alive. I'm killing the process. Hold on. I can't stream shit from YouTube live. Let's do fucking Firefox. Nope, not that one. I'm sorry, guys. Had I been able to download it, this would be no problem, but hey.
Shoot, that audio problem caused a disaster. We had it going.
I know, right? Oh, well. Okay, we'll get it going again. There.
Did my audio problem mix in with this one?
No, completely different. My whole setup's just a Rube Goldberg machine. That's the only
When Brian talks, I get stereo. When you talk, Clinton, you're just in one ear.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'll fix that when I have time to attend to small quibbles as opposed to major technical difficulties. We'll add a ticket to the support queue. Please add a ticket.
This footage is from what we're trying to... Sorry, you have, technical issues to say there, Quentin? Or?
No, I'm being witty to fill time.
Oh, okay.
Explain the film.
Yeah, so this is the clip, we're trying to pull up the YouTube, but the trouble is it's a long YouTube film, it's a full movie. It's one of David Cronenberg's first movies, which is called Crimes of the Future from 1970. His brand new movie that's premiering this week is also called Crimes of the Future, and it's not a remake, it's not exactly the same story, but there are some shared elements, apparently, and I might be wrong, but I got the impression that one of the shared elements is the thing that's talked about in this weird little speech about this particular patient at the institute and his very odd condition. So, but yeah, it should be, I'm interested to see the new one for sure. It's been a while since David Cronenberg has made a movie that he wrote himself. It's been quite a while, actually. The last one was Existenz, years ago.
I thought Existenz, yeah. Coming home from Existenz, walking through Central Park, there was Woody Allen and his girlfriend.
That was then, right.
99 about, and I looked at him, he looked at me and I nodded at him. He nodded at me. I didn't do anything. He nodded at me. And then I was surprised by the whole thing. And then he kept on walking. And a little later I said, oh, fuck. I could have run over and asked about McLuhan and the making of Annie Hall.
Yeah.
But when I saw him, my instinct was to give him his privacy. Yeah. If it was a more public thing where you're allowed to talk to him, I would have said something. But that was my one interaction after that movie. Existenz.
Yeah.
And he's a comedian. So look at the symbolism. He's a comedian of existential agony all the time. Right. He's always doing existence, right?
Look. There we go. There's the sound. All right, but we got to go back.
Is he explaining it to the other people?
He's just explaining it to the viewer, really.
Okay.
But, so this is the thing. It's got a very strange soundtrack. It's just weird sounds, but it's been long periods of silence. This is not necessarily a question. So yeah, the speech about the patient and they're wrapped up. To describe it.
My former colleague has somehow withdrawn. He himself has contracted a species of venereal disease from one of his patients. He was once a fierce sensualist, but he has now become a pure metaphysician. His body has begun to create puzzling organs, each one very complex. Very perfect, unique, yet seemingly without function. As each is surgically removed, it is quickly replaced by another equally mysterious. He has taken to breaking into the specimens room and stealing the jars containing these organs. His body, he insists, is a galaxy. And these creatures are solar systems. He becomes melancholy when they are far from him. His nurse says that his disease is possibly a form of creative cancer. I believe that this is what they have said. It is difficult to recall so many dialects when one has remained so long in isolation.
Wow.
Yep. That's the speech.
So explain some of it.
The guy, this person is somehow has contracted some kind of disease that they're just generating these, spurious organs, generating these, useless organs, but very complex new organs that don't do anything. And, they keep removing them, but he doesn't, you know, he had some kind of, problem with them being removed from him. But, just this idea of him constantly creating these new organs, I was reminded of that. I think that's an interesting thing, but I also was reminded of that, by the phrase, the rapid series of innovations is an ersatz anti-environment or something, because I was listening to, again, Bob, you talking about Adam Pugin's article, and at some point you were bringing it back to the kind of raw physical nervous system aspect of the Kluin, where, you know, we've extended the nervous system and we have this numbing action to keep us sane. So we're numb to that. But, what was it that you, I had to write it down. What was it? You said something to the effect of, I put it in the chat. Let's see. You used a particular phrasing.
Yeah, rapid series of innovations, ersatz, anti-environments.
Yeah.
Page 31 of Counterblast. So what's interesting, so the bottle has organs that the guy with the thing over his head, sitting on the bench, is making in his body.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. That's a metaphor. He came up with it in 1970. It's a metaphor for new chip body, TT body. He's making new things.
It's a,
right.
You, so you said, just a nitpick, but perhaps to creative ends, you said somehow he contracted this disease, Brian, but it was quite specific in the speech. You said a venereal disease.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, from one of his patients.
He's a sensuist who's become a pure metaphysician after contracting this venereal disease, which now has led to this organ generation, so.
Yeah, there's a certain, like, the script is very, like, suggestive. It suggests a lot of very fantastic things that it doesn't go into a whole lot of detail about, unfortunately, that movie. I mean, it's cool. It's its own thing. It leaves you wanting to know more about the story. But, basically this place seems to be some sort of one of these kind of experimental, super progressive, anti-psychiatry asylums.
R.D. Lang, the famous guy in 1970.
Yeah.
So the guy who put the blanket over his head, he's a psychiatrist.
No, the guy who put the blanket over his head, I believe, is the patient he's talking about. It was the guy on the left who's the narrator who was talking to us.
The guy with the bottles, he's talking to us.
It was the guy who wasn't, it was the third guy is the narrator. The guy who had the bottles was like an orderly or something, or a nurse. And
well, who's the third guy?
The guy with the thing over his head was the patient or the guy with the weird condition.
Who's the John Lennon doctor. Motherfucker?
The narrator is the John Lennon motherfucker.
Okay.
Who's like,
is the what?
The guy
the narrator.
John Lennon.
Who's the other person on the bench?
The guy with the bottle, the guy sitting on the bench?
No. Yeah, okay. Sitting with the drape guy, you know, the clothes over. Who's the other person? Looks like a woman.
That's the narrator. That's the one who runs the institute.
Oh, the guy there with the glasses beside the guy who puts the drape over himself.
Yeah, Bob, the John Lennon motherfucker. The
guy with the John Lennon glasses is our narrator.
And he's explaining what those organs are that the orderly's holding up. Yeah. And he's running the patient. He's not doing much, but then the orderly grabs him and takes him away.
Yeah.
We assume the John Lennon guy ordered that.
Yeah. Like the guy needs to be, you know, I mean, that he doesn't, he says that the guy doesn't like to be separated from his organs, but then, and he talks about how they are surgically removed, but he doesn't say anything about that they're like threatening his health and have to be surgically removed. Like maybe they're just curious about them, so they're surgically removing them and studying them. Like we don't know, like maybe this guy has a legitimate complaint about like, hey, let me fill up my body cavity with these fucked up organs. What do you care? Don't take them out. I don't know.
Maybe he's...
That is left very ambiguous.
Maybe these organs are his mind babies. His creative cancer are his mind babies made manifest in the flesh. Right? Since he's become a metaphysician, he's still a sexual being reproducing out of his mind.
All right.
I think Cronenberg, that's a pretty amazing movie, 1970...
Yeah.
His following movies are spelling out what he didn't really know what he was saying, but he had read McLuhan, and he was trying to figure out extensions and new organs. He's trying to translate McLuhan in 1970, and all the later movies are further understandings of that first movie. And that's
it. And it's fascinating, because I know that, you know...
That's why he had the same title. He's come back to it with new understanding.
Yeah. Now the new one has the same title, and it's not the same premise. There are things that are different about it, but apparently there are some things that are similar, and I somehow got the impression that this idea of the people growing new organs is one of the ideas that is in the new movie as well.
Yeah, and I think he probably reads Croker, and I don't know if you read this book, but Croker's book fits the scene. You know, right. That's what we're up against. We're growing new things beyond the chemical body.
Yeah.
And
well, and it really also ties into this thing that, because I guess it's not very well known because it wasn't a movie, but Cronenberg did this cool art installation at the Toronto International Film Festival building at King and John. He did this really cool installation about, like a pod. He's like, we're coming out with these pods, and it looks kind of like an Existenz living thing. It sort of felt like a spin-off of Existenz. But, the idea was that they had people there saying like, oh yeah, we'll sign you up and we will 3D printers were like brand new. And like, we will 3D print you your very own pod, and you will begin a relationship with your pod. And it will, like, there were basically various things about how it's going to be a kind of a, it was sort of like a weird dream Cronenbergian nightmare version of like your smartphone. Or it's going to be like a thing that is, it's like a flesh pod that attaches to you and will allow you to participate in like some virtual space, basically.
You're describing the new movie, or you're translating 1970?
No, I'm describing something that a totally different project
the installation
that he did in about 2007 or something. It was whenever they had a Cronenberg retrospective there, and they had like a museum set up. You could go see some of the props from this movie. You could go get your picture taken sitting next to the mugwump from Naked Lunch, and see like some of the cool props from Videodrome and stuff. It was awesome. But and so upstairs he had this new installation that like to me it just seemed like a very cool response to the idea of, I don't know, maybe getting people to think about the relationship that they were embarking on with the brand new at that time smartphone technology. That it's kind of like an organ that you're adding to your body, and it might create vulnerability for you.
That's what I would, that's the exact word I would use on CKLN. I would explain extension, and I started to talk about the new bodies. I would say the TV is a new lung, a new organ attached to your chemical body. And so I would use the word organ. It'd be funny if you heard me saying that. But I see that his young, immature science fiction horror movie mind came up with this grueling, disgusting first attempt.
Right.
Crimes of the future. That Croker's describing the future we already live in, so it doesn't exist. It's already here. So it sort of overlays with, Croker gets a little perverse in his earlier books talking about these new things. And then he does in 2000, he's interested in the perversions in the laboratories. You get an ear attached to a rat and it runs around and does shit. You know what I mean? A rat ear. They're doing the lab, kicked out students. So, actually, good serendipity. Let me do that.
Do it. Oh, no. Fuck, okay. Let's try he's got two ear pods lifted. Do that one. Okay, here now. No, okay, we gotta go back to it. Listen, we...
We're live.
Okay.
I clicked up.
Okay, good. You were starting to crackle up. Last time we used your earpods to fix it, but now you don't have your earpods, so we'll just keep refreshing every once in a while and keep you going.
There. Right, and you're slightly crackly to me.
Oh.
Very slightly. Do you get that, Brian? He's not perfect. Clinton's...
A little bit stuttery sometimes on the audio cutting out but not
static sound.
Okay.
It's not overwhelming.
Okay.
So the serendipity, Accidental Treasures, is you bringing up this movie. It totally complements all that we've been talking about, especially the Croker part. And in early Croker, he had more disgusting imagery, and he would talk about Cronenberg, I think. He'd bring in Cronenberg. So that's Cronenberg is an interesting product of the Toronto School of Communication. Oh, yeah, that's what's interesting about the book. He tries to upgrade everybody's definition of the school of Toronto School of Communication. He says the real argument is between Havelock and McLuhan. And that's the basis of the battle between the oral culture and the new culture. So, Havelock's a historian of the oral culture, Homer's time, how it got altered by the phonetic alphabet in Plato. And McLuhan jumps from that into projecting a future condition, which is utopian, the new oral culture. And so the debate is that Havelock says oral culture is conservative, regressive, and crummy, and it's not a good thing. They have the exact opposite view of McLuhan's oral culture. But what Croker doesn't understand is McLuhan's not celebrating oral culture. Oral culture is the content. McLuhan's celebrating tactile culture. So it's a major mistake by Croker in understanding McLuhan. And he makes it the conclusion of his book, and he's kind of saying, hey, Lance Drake, MEA, you need to update your Toronto School of Communication, and focus it around this debate between McLuhan and Havelock. Huh. Yeah, it's a very obscure point. But if he was right about McLuhan, then he'd have a point. But he's not right about McLuhan. So it's a fake fucking thing that Croker's come up with, consciously or unconsciously, to distinguish himself from all the other McLuhan guys that he ignores and will not interact with very much. Like, Lance, I got Lance back in 98 to invite Croker to the symposium, or Lance had already done it, but I brought up Croker, and he said, Croker, he said, I'm too busy. He did not want to get involved in that whole scene in New York around Postman. I don't know how much he knew about it, and he was very popular at that point. Croker was the top guy out of Canada. That he may have been too, sincerely too busy. But he's never made any overtures other than to come to Derek's conference in 1998. And when I was talking to Croker at David Cook's the night of the Bruce Powell conference the year before in 97. And there's going to be a debate between Postman and Croker in Sunday of that weekend where the Heaven's Gate people killed themselves. The fad of Hail Bob, you know, that the thing was coming, Hail Bob, and the church have made a lot of jokes about it. But Croker, I was putting down the McLuhanstein, and he said, no, de Kerckhoff's okay. He liked de Kerckhoff. I didn't. And I quoted McLuhan talking to me through the Everbees, putting down Derek. And I don't know what Croker thought of that. But the next night, when they all attacked Croker, you know, Tom Cooper and Logan, they interrupted Croker's talk and said, we're channeling McLuhan. McLuhan is here. And Tom Cooper or Logan claimed that McLuhan was coming through them and told Croker to shut up. It's all bullshit. And so, again, I think right now it was all perfect timing because I was sitting with Croker and Mary Louise, but I'm behind Mary Louise. So as the argument breaks out and becomes apparent what they're doing, she leaned back to me. She says, isn't this your department, Bob? Because I just told him we're talking to everybody the night before. So they rudely attack Croker. I think Mary Louise gets up and defends them, but they're ridiculous. It really is the fourth school of mediocrity, the literate guys, the book guys, Bruce Powell, the Thompson, William Thompson, Postman, Logan, de Kerckhoff, Nicol, they're all book guys, and they can't handle what's really coming. They want to preserve book culture. They understand McLuhan intellectually, but they're all book people. So Croker's not a book person. Look, you know, he's the New York School of mediocrity out of Severo Lutrenge and the postmodern guys, who Lance, I understand, won't have anything to deal with. So Croker's ahead of them. They can't take Croker. So they interrupt him rudely. I mean, I was even amazed that Croker was there, because he wasn't ever part of that scene as far as I knew. But he told me the year before that he liked de Kerckhoff. So he came to the de Kerckhoff conference the next year and they fucking attacked him. And I don't remember Derek defending or doing anything. He let the attack happen. As a matter of fact, we had supper, Croker, me, and Mary Louise before his talk. And, so all of a sudden, Croker looks at me, he sort of out of the blue says, so Bob, what's going to happen? You know, he asked me to tell him something that he knew I knew that he wondered if I knew. He says, what should I do or something? Like, how should I deal with this thing where I've got to talk? So the talk was going to be after Saturday night, after the dinner. I remember him hanging out with Steve Mann, and I listened to him talk to Steve Mann, who's mentioned in the book. And the whole phenomenon. Steve Mann was attracted to Croker, not those other guys, you know. So Croker says, what's up, Bob? They said, take your best slap shot. And he and Mary Louise look at each other like a private. Holy fuck, Bob knows. Bob's cool. He had the right metaphor. We're going to have to take a slap shot at these fuckers. So he gets, so then comes the talk in the evening. He gets up there and he's fucking slamming away. Back then, Croker would just talk his stuff that he wrote, complex, and just like push it on everybody. He didn't care whether anybody heard it or understood it. He just kept saying it and he'd go on and on and on. I saw him do this in New York in 94. So he started doing that, but Logan and I weren't going to have that. They stopped him very quickly and tried to put him down with this ridiculous thing about channeling. But they didn't know that I already discussed channeling serendipitously the night before. So Mary Louise had someone to talk to do on the side. Hey, Bob, this is your department. And I laughed. So they stopped Croker. I don't remember what happened. Like, did he ever get to continue? Maybe they did, but it was ridiculous. And that's then,
scandal. Come on.
What?
That's a scandal. Come on.
It's a scandal. But it showed you that always the identity crisis of people still trying to figure out McLuhan had not caught up with the new changes. Derek knew the new changes. He had a conference in 83 with Thiel and Baudrillard, you know, very early. But Derek didn't talk that stuff. He, you know, Gad flied around in between so that he'd be at the Venice Biennial or whatever those biennial things in Europe, and he'd get to interview Virilio or something. They didn't pick Bruce Powell or Logan or anybody else, Tom Cooper. They picked Derek. So Derek was savvy enough to be in touch with what was happening in the 90s, whereas these old thingamajigs were back trying to defend McClune, keep McClune alive at the University of Toronto, almost a rear guard action. So they couldn't take Croker, and it came out. You don't fucking have a series conference and attack somebody with the ridiculous notion that they're channeling McClune. They were not taking the Croker seriously. And they didn't know the real fucking guy who's channeling McClune, me, was in the fucking audience. Okay. So at the end of the talk, it wrapped up. And Liz Jeffrey is somehow the controller of that night, the authority. So she gets up and says, okay, is that it? Everybody said something? And Mary Lee said, nobody said anything. I stood up and said, no, I got to say something. And so I walked to the front, almost not saying anything. And she's looking at me, it seemed, uh-oh, what's this? This is the monster guy. But I walked with such confidence, I think, or something, she backed off. But she didn't have that personality backing off, but she backed off and let me stand there in the podium. And I'm going to have the last word. So right. I could pretty well say what I said. I said, I met a man once. Now, I'm on the podium, sitting on the floor to my right is Croker and Mary Louise. Sitting on my left is Tikhurkov. So these two, in fact, the two somethings, the two 90s guys are on either side of me. And so I kind of look at them. I address them. I said, recently I met this man, and he could bring this. So basically I was talking about Michael Blake Reed and the Evergreens, right? But I didn't say it that way. But I met this old guy. It was pretty interesting, very talented, and dead people could come through him. You could speak to dead people. So I asked to speak to Marshall McLuhan, and the guy obliged, and McLuhan came forward. So what did I ask McLuhan? I said, now this is 98. The web is still sort of new. I said, Marshall, would you create a website? Would you get involved with this new technology? Would you grow a new organ? You know? Yeah. And McClune, you know, he always knew what was going on. Sammy got involved. He hung out with Leary a little bit, right? He helped Leary do stuff. He touched on the new. He wouldn't totally run from it. So we're wondering, what's he going to do about this fucking medium that's going to wipe out the human? It's going to make all his warnings about the electric age killing the Catholic religion and being a Catholic. It's going to be worse with the internet. Okay, so I asked him a question. What would you do? He says, yes, I would create a website, but I'd get James Joyce to write the instructions on how to find it.
Right.
Perfect fucking answer. That, yeah. That he said through the Evergreens. Perfect. I mean, assuming you can't understand Joyce, so no one could find it, but he'd be on there. He wouldn't be totally a Luddite. He'd participate, but he'd create a detachment that it would be hard to find him. Yeah. So I said that. I laid it out really good, you know, like a comedian, perfect rhythm. And everybody laughed their heads off, and it was a big, victorious thing. And I look over, you know, Croker is sort of looking, nodding, and Derek's not looking at me. And so I sort of picked up the Croker, got it, and Derek didn't like it. And so I walked off, and that's how the conference ended. It was my triumphant fucking anecdote, right?
Yeah, ending it on a joke.
Yeah,
true story.
And I shared with McClune. I got Michael Brinkley to talk to me, and it's not, the whole thing was leading to that. These guys were in a fucked up way. New channeling was coming up. All he knew was I was the guy who called him up in 91 to get permission to put quotes in my Fatty Communion book.
Right.
And then I met him in 94 at New York, that whole scene in New York of the commie guys, Stanley somebody, you know, the Mark Gary world, all the hip guys were there. They put out a book. It's a very good book, Science Fiction, New Technologies. So they were trying to deal with the Internet. This is 94, before the Internet. So that's when Croker, I noticed that I was in the audience, and Croker showed up one afternoon or noon morning, and he was just sitting there listening to the speaker. And then, and the question period, I spoke up and said something. And that was okay. And I was on the other side of the room from Croker. Then I started thinking in the corner of my, Croker's staring at me.
Yeah.
Okay. And he kept staring at me because he might have recognized my voice and said, oh, that's the guy who got the quotes back in 91. As a matter of fact, when I told him that I was getting William Irwin Thompson's quotes, I say, Thompson never heard of you. And Arthur says, oh, that's weird. As if Thompson should know about Croker. It's strange that Thompson never heard of him. So I'm mixing Thompson.
You would have had to have heard of him if he had taken over the coach house. You would have had to have stayed up on all that.
Who would have? What are we saying here?
William Irwin Thompson.
Yeah, Thompson. That's right. Yeah, Thompson. And that's he was going to take over in 84. That's when the book came out by Croker, McLuhan, Innocent Grant.
Yeah.
That major – that put Arthur on the McLuhan map. Yes, William Thompson under just for those listening, under Conrad Black's sponsorship, would have had to know Croker. But Croker was surprised that he hadn't heard him. But look at what I did. You know, the whole New Age world is Thompson with the little McLuhan in him. LaRouche is fucking way somewhere else, right? And Thompson's aware of LaRouche and has a little battle with him. But then you've got Croker. LaRouche and Thompson don't know Croker. And then I have Marshall McLuhan. They've all heard of McLuhan, but they don't know anything about him, really. Different levels. Croker knows the most. So that's, you know, Croker must have wondered, why is this guy putting Thompson, who doesn't know about me, and Croker and McLuhan and LaRouche in this book? And I don't know. And I told him it was a way to attack the church of the subgenius. We must create a counter-environment to the church of the subgenius. That's what the book was doing.
Yeah,
so
man.
I think of that. And he said back in 91, he said, that's cool, I like that. But yeah. I never saw him again. So now it's 94. I don't know if he ever heard my voice. He's fucking staring at me, I think. I don't know, but it looks like he stopped looking at the eye. He's fucking staring at me. And he's saying, he's probably saying, I've heard that voice. Who is that fucking guy?
Yeah, so now it's 94.
What?
Now it's 94?
Yeah, in 94, he's in New York. He's staring at me. It feels that way. I don't look at him to see if he's staring at me. I just think he's looking at me, so I maintain my cool. But probably what I fucking said, I probably had a very crazy Croker-esque fucking question or point in the conference. You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't remember getting much response, but it probably got Croker's attention. So,
I'm just wondering if he, you know, if you had said to him, you know, presuming that I assume that when you called him for permission for the quotes, that was the first he heard of you, that he didn't hear you.
No, he didn't know anything about me. So, though somebody played on CKLN around that time, his audio, where it was a little tape they made called The Ear Must Be Destroyed. And I talked about it. I said, that's interesting. He right. might have been aware of somebody at CKLN knew about me, heard me, and told him. But he doesn't indicate any of that in 91.
He certainly wouldn't have known that you were, you know, Bob Dobbs.
No, he knew nothing about me, I assume, unless someone told him.
So it's just interesting. Giving you permission to use his quotes in 1991, you said, and thinking that, like, oh, yeah, that's a cool idea. Like, I like that. We need to create an anti-environment to the counter-environment to the Church of Subgenius. Yeah, good thinking. And then, you know, 2 years later, sometime over the next 2 years, becoming aware
94.
Yes.
91, 94. He's at the conference in New York.
Sometime between then, I'm imagining.
He could have heard the album. He could have heard the album.
Yeah.
Yes, he could have heard the album.
Of the Church of Subgenius' answer at it.
Yeah.
And that he's like caught up in it, and he's one of the stars of your constellation.
Yeah. Right.
And
yeah.
He could have been like looking at you like, oh shit, I didn't expect this guy to really like
to show up here among his tribe.
Like, what do I think? Oh no, now we lost Bob's audio. I don't hear you.
Okay, Clinton's fixing it. I clicked it twice. Okay, so yes, I know Croker more than he knows me, right? I see him there. So I'm looking at him. I said, oh, Croker's here. Good. I knew he was here. That's why I went to the conference. I knew he'd be there. And a lot of other guys I wanted to find. I saw a lot of people who were big, you know, semi-media colleges in New York at that scene. So he's staring at me. But you're right. I forgot about the album. He says, that fucking was a pretty crazy question. It's that fucking voice. I know that voice. He's probably said, where have I heard that voice? He's probably puzzled. So I had a sense he was just staring at me. So then it stopped, I think, and we just carried on with the conference. So later on, I wanted to give him the memo to Prince Charles. I had a printout of it from the album. So I go outside, and I see him go outside, so I'm going to go out and get him outside when he's by himself. But when I get out there, he's with Mary Louise. And they're talking privately. So I'm stuck. So I said, Arthur, and I handed them the paper and then left. I knew I was interrupting something personal. So he takes the paper and he just jams it into his pocket. It's all scrunched up. He had no respect for the paper I gave him. And I don't know what he did with that. But that night, he and Mary Louise are showing some footage, and there was a cinema thing. You know, movies and other media.
Yeah.
Everybody was there. So when I get there, before it starts, Croker and two or three other guys, I remember one guy was real tall, are talking. Three Illuminati of that scene, you know, three guys. Three or four. So I walk over and I just position myself in the one empty space, and I'm looking at the tall guy, and there's Croker on one side, someone else on the other side, and I just was staring at them. And they stare back at me. And quite quickly, I'm interrupting something. I am not qualified to be there. So I just keep standing there. And they sort of say, okay, this guy's not going to leave. So they start talking a little bit. But I decided, no, I'm being rude. So I listened to it for a little bit, and I left. Okay, so that was Kroger's next encounter. I was claiming, it seemed, that I was equal to the inner circle. I'm just a weird guy that he might
be familiar now.
Yeah. So, as usual, I bond with the outsider. There's this guy named Noam, N-O-A-M, and he's a fucking fantastic guy from the beatniks and the hippies. He's a historian of the New York counterculture. He knew everybody, Walter Bord, East Village. I just got talking to him because I was sitting beside him waiting for the thing to start. And I realized this guy is, he's an interesting guy to meet. Yeah. So we then started to watch the Croker stuff. And Noam starts yelling out comments at the movie. And so I start commenting. And so the Croker's sitting up quite in front of us near the movie. So we're fucking barraging the fucking thing. As Croker's sitting there, one of the movies was him eating a McDonald's burger, okay? It was a big deal. Him eating a McDonald's burger. The synthetic world of virtual food. And so as we were doing this, Mary Louise looks back and smiles and nods at us. So I honestly realized I had never seen her before. Yeah, I had not ever seen her. And I didn't see her at the conference. Other than when I interrupted them, and he didn't like me interrupting, he scrumpled up the paper. But here's Mary Louise. I don't know her. She's looking back, and she's nodding, smiling. I said, holy fuck, she's cool. You know what I mean? She liked what me and Noam were saying. So that was good. And so then they discussed the films and show stuff. And then everybody, like at 10:30, was leaving. So I followed Croker out to see where he was going because I wanted to keep talking to him. So we get out on 42nd Street. It's the famous NYU place there at 42nd Street and 5th or something. It's a big part of somebody's university. And so we get out in front and everybody's mingling, but Croker is finished. So he starts walking off to the left down the street with Mary Louise. You know, it's almost midnight. And so I yell out, is it over? Is it over? And Arthur says, yeah, we're finished, Bob. We're finished. I said, okay. And they walk off. Okay? So Bob Schnoid from Sheboygan, our crumb character, right, was trying to get in there and teach him some shit, all right? I'm there pretending I'm a follower, but I'm actually fucking a leader, and he needs to be corrected on some points. But I never got the opportunity. So that is 94. The next time I see him is in 98 at the Kirchhoff's conference, and Steve Mann is talking to him. So I go over and eavesdrop on Steve Mann and him. Now, Steve Mann was saying what – he actually brought up Mae Brussel top-down kinds of information. He didn't quote Mae Brussel. He was saying, well, Arthur – you know, if I keep doing this and then the secret elite start getting mad at me, they'll kill me. So this was a Bob Dobbs kind of question for Arthur. What does he make of the top-down LaRouche, Mae Brussel, paranoid conspiracy world? And Arthur just sort of said, no, he was very lackadaisical. No, I thought it is. He didn't address the issue well enough. He didn't go into it. I would have fucking told Steve Mann a whole bunch of shit and scared the shit out of him. You know what I mean? That I was the guy he was looking for, and I had to show up right when he asked that so I could know he was the guy he was looking for. But I never got to talk to him because Steve kept talking to Croker. So then the dinner starts, and that's where I end up at a table, and for some reason, I don't know, maybe they sat down. I probably would say, where are they sitting? I'm going to fucking sit wherever he sits and fucking invade him. So I end up sitting with him, and I don't know if he knew me or what. What could he know? He must have known something. Because we're eating politely in that, and Mary Louise says, you from Nova Scotia? I said, yeah, I've lived there. She says, that's a beautiful place. We just were down there. She goes on about how great Nova Scotia is. And so they knew, they'd heard I had some connection. So they did know something by 98 about me, it seems. So then there's a pause, and then Croker says, so Bob, what am I up against? He knew that there was something brewing, that he was an outsider, you know? And I didn't know he liked the Kirchhoff at that point. So I think he's totally, nobody likes him. And then the events unfolded and they attacked him, and I don't see Derek helping him or anything. I don't even remember where Derek was. He wasn't even there. But it was totally silly, and I told you what happened. Then I had the triumphant ending. And the next day or so, I called Croker, he's back in Montreal, and he praised what I did. He thought it was really neat. De Kirchhoff never congratulated me on what I did, but Arthur did. Arthur could fucking absorb the present. He could be aware of something that was good. So so then Croker, do I ever see him again? I don't think so. I occasionally would call him over the next year or so, and we talked for a while, but then he said, I got to go mark papers. So he was, that was a McLuhan, the joke Tom Wolfe had about McLuhan, that everybody's trying to, yeah, you remember that? In the Tom Wolfe essay, everybody's after trying to get McLuhan's attention, but he can't see anybody because he's marking papers. In other words, he became a celebrity, but it didn't change his lifestyle.
Yeah.
He didn't leave college or anything. And he also wanted him to move to the States and become a professor down there, and he rejected all that. So I like McLuhan's monkish Christian detachment from the whole storm he created, you know? He knew what he was doing. So Croker, so he moves out to British Columbia. He leaves Concordia and goes out to Victoria and gets a chair there. All right? He got a chair. Just like Janine Marchessault has a chair.
Yeah.
And Janine told me years ago that it's a fucking ripoff. You have to do a lot of work and, you don't get anything out of it. She felt that way. I don't know if Arthur was getting anything out of it, but he had a chair. And, I read his book. It came out around 2001 or two, where he talked about his students. What are you doing?
What?
Are you eating, or are you just doing Greg? Okay.
No, I baked a piece of the bread. I baked two loaves of bread. I just pulled them out of the oven.
Awesome.
This is a fruit and raisin hazelnut honey, and look at the shiny bottom there.
Yeah, nice. Yep. Nice. Very
I got
good.
Another one in there too. I got a red fife and regular there. I just made these now.
Yeah, we just started eating that bread with raisins made by some local person, and it's really good. And Carolyn gets it at the market.
I make it myself. Look at this.
Yeah, so is this lady. She made it. Okay, so you're being Gary Ganosko. Gary Ganosko at the McLuhan Festival in 2004. He gets up to talk about McLuhan, representing Janine Marceau and the York contingent, who are also outsiders to the downtown Toronto scene. And he talks about baking fucking bread. That's what he talked about. He talked about baking bread. So you're doing Ganosko.
It's exciting. Making your own bread. It's terrific.
Yeah. So I'm going to get these stories on record. Cause Coker may listen to this. So I'm wondering, I'm always asking people, okay, we had a conference in 2004. Why don't you fucking invite Coker? Nobody would invite Coker. He was either so far above them and they didn't understand them and they didn't even know the connection to McLuhan or something, or they're afraid of him or they didn't like him or something. But I'd always advocate for Coker from 98 up till I went to New York till I went to Hawaii in 2008. I'm operating out of New York from 93 to 2008. So Croker puts out this book, talks about this change. He's not going to talk about digital reality anymore. He's going to talk about the labs and the monsters. It's the Cronenberg point of the monsters being made in labs, because he says that's what the kids were aware of, his students, and he needed to discuss it with them, work them through it. So he had shifted out of the cyber thing. And then he spent the next couple of years putting out anthologies of essays that were on C theory. You know, critical delirium or some digital delirium one, digital delirium two. He wasn't putting too much stuff out. I think he put some fiction out, but that might have been earlier, some poetry. People didn't like that the people I talked to. But I would read anything Croker did. So I kept up on C theory and all that he was doing until 2013. I went over to Vancouver to see Chad and Angela. Then I went down to San Francisco to see Jack Sarfatti, and I met Madeline and Bill Turk, who's the guy who makes the, you see him occasionally posting, sometimes called Willie Benign. He's in the film world and he works at DreamWorks and other big things since there. He's a friend of Jerry Fialka. So Bill wanted to make a documentary on Cosmic Awareness, the Evergreens, and then me and Ion. So that was always talked about, because he had gone to Olympia, Washington, the Evergreen College there, that Dave Worcester, Channel for Cosmic Awareness, had advised the president in 66-67 how to run the school. And so the school is known as a hyper-liberal place. And, you know, and Matt Groening went there, and his legacy is there, and Bill went there after Matt Groening. So I meet them, and he and I, you can see on the internet, we go see Bob Carr, who Ian's always joking about, the old friend of Worcester. And so there's some good interviews with Bob Carr. While I'm there, I go over to Victoria to see an Ionaut named Sasha. And while I'm there, I said, I got to go up and see Croker at his office. So I find out where it is, and I go up there. It's like a Friday afternoon maybe or something, and it's 5:00. So I get to the door. It's locked. I can't get in. Now, it doesn't look like he's going to be there, but a guy drives up on a bicycle. He might have been a janitor or something, and he opens the door to get in. I said, hey, and he just let me walk in, which was stupid. You don't let strangers walk into a university when it's all locked up, but I had the forces working for me. He lets me walk in, so I walk around that floor to find Croker's office. I find the office, and the fucking, I knock, the door is open. It's ajar. Yeah. Okay? Everything was, I found out later that Ian did all this for me. Okay? But anyways, I go to, it's ajar, but a polite, I knock on the door. No answer. Knock, knock, knock. Really make sure they know someone's there, if there's anybody in the office. There's nobody in the office. So I slowly open the fucking door. So now I'm in Croker's office and I get to spy on the whole fucking environment. For a half an hour or so. So I examine the library on his office shelf, what books he's reading. I look at the desk. There's several desks. See what papers are. He's marking up something, you know. I rudely, illegally, fucking spy on everything about him, which if he was there, we were talking, I wouldn't notice any of that. I would be talking to him, pay attention to him, and only see him. Totally. But I got to see, what'd you say?
Just saying, totally. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'd be focused on him. I focus on people more than the environment, so to speak. But now I can look at the environment, and I got to spy on Croker way more than I ever could have. And it worked, because I took the stupid gamble of going up there at the wrong time, not knowing Ian would help me, and ridiculously getting there late. It took the bus and everything, and I get there late, and a fucking janitor comes by, lets me in. I go down the office, find the door, it's a janitor, and I get to fucking talk about it. So, I mean, to see everything. So a day or so later, I call, I'm still there, and I call him up, and Croker, I get to Croker, I think, and he says, we're just leaving town, can't meet, can't talk. He's got to go. So I never got to meet him. And so I always wondered if I'd ever tell the story about how I spied on the show. I have told it on Tailgate, you know, years ago, so now it's on record. If he ever hears this, if he listens to the 400-hour tape we're going to send him, he'll hear this, what I did. And so, and then a year or two later, I say 2015 or 16, I called to ask him something, and he didn't have much to say. He wasn't interested in talking much, so who knows? Maybe he found out that I had invaded his office. All the time that I'm in the office and the door's open, that means someone's around. Someone's going to come back, right? You would assume he could have been down in the bathroom or something, and he comes back. And so I had to be careful while I'm looking to be ready to be sitting in the chair properly as if I was just politely waiting for somebody to come back, right? So I'd sit there, nobody's coming, go spy for a few minutes. They go back and sit in the chair where I'm supposed to sit, you know, while waiting for the appointment with the professor. Doing all this stuff so I don't get caught. And I never got caught, and it was a great victory. And I mean, I was looking at, it's interesting the books he had on the shelf. He was keeping up with what the shit was out there. You know, as a professor, he had to be up on what was happening. So he had a lot of stupid books there, but good ones or obscure ones. And then again, what if that wasn't his shelf? And I was looking at someone else's shelf in the office. I don't know. I remember calling the secretary in there somewhere and just checking to see what she'd say. And I tried to make an appointment, but there was no appointment. But I think I talked to Croker, too, and he said he was leaving town. And then in 2016, when I talked to him on the phone, I thought I might be going up there again. He was very busy. Yes, he said that he had problems. Mary Louise's mother was dying. So he was very preoccupied with that. So it wasn't a good time for me to drop in and see him. So that's the last I interacted with him. Now I'm doing his book, and I'm going to be the only fucking person in the world to do justice to his fucking book. All right?